Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Tristan Storytime. I'm Tristan Gardner. I'm so glad you're able to join me once again for another great episode. On today's program, you'll get a chance to listen to some great stories. Plus, as a special treat, you'll get to listen to my poetry reading skills for the very first time. Now, isn't that exciting? You want to know what poem I'm going to read? Just keep listening to this program and you'll find out. And as always, feel free to use your imaginations, because this is what this podcast is all about, using your imaginations. So find a seat and get comfortable, because another episode of Tristan Storytime is about to begin. Have you ever met a frog who liked to fish? Well, now's your chance, because I'm going to tell you a story about a frog who absolutely loves to fish. And it's all in the tale of Mr. Jeremy Fisher, written and illustrated by Beatrix Potter. Once upon a time, there was a frog called Mr. Jeremy Fisher. He lived in a little damp house amongst the buttercups at the edge of a pond. The water was all slippy sloppy in the larder and in the back passage, but Mr. Jeremy liked getting his feet wet. Nobody ever scolded him, and he never got a cold. He was quite pleased when he looked out and saw large drops of rain splashing in the pond. "I will get some worms and go fishing and catch a dish of minnows for my dinner," said Mr. Jeremy Fisher. "If I catch more than 5 fish, I will invite my friends, Mr. Alderman Ptolemy Tortoise and Sir Isaac Newton. The alderman, however, eats salad." Mr. Jeremy put on a Macintosh and a pair of shiny galoshes. He took his rod and basket and set off with enormous hops to the place where he kept his boat. The boat was round and green and very like the other lily leaves. It was tied to a water plant in the middle of the pond. Mr. Jeremy took a reed pole and pushed the boat out into the open water. "I know a good place for minnows," said Mr. Jeremy Fisher. Mr. Jeremy stuck his pole into the mud and fastened the boat to it. Then he settled himself cross-legged and arranged his fishing tackle. He had the dearest little red float. His rod was a tough stalk of grass. His line was a fine long white horsehair, and he tied a little wriggling worm at the end. The rain trickled down his back, and for nearly an hour, he stared at the float.
"This is getting tiresome. I think I should like some lunch," said Mr. Jeremy Fisher.
He punted back again amongst the water plants and took some lunch out of his basket.
"I will eat a butterfly sandwich and wait till the shower's over," said Mr. Jeremy Fisher.
A great big water beetle came up underneath the lily leaf and tweaked the toe of one of his galoshes. Mr. Jeremy crossed his legs up shorter, out of reach, and went on eating his sandwich. Once or twice, something moved about with a rustle and a splash amongst the rushes at the side of the pond.
"I trust that is not a rat," said Mr. Jeremy Fisher. "I think I had better get away from here."
Mr. Jeremy shoved the boat out again a little way and dropped in the bait. There was a bite almost directly. The float gave a tremendous bobbit.
"A minnow! A minnow! I have him by the nose!"
cried Mr. Jeremy Fisher, jerking up his rod. But what a horrible surprise! Instead of a smooth, fat minnow, Mr. Jeremy landed Little Jack Sharp, the stickleback, covered with spines. The stickleback floundered about the boat, pricking and snapping until he was quite out of breath. Then he jumped back into the water, and a shoal of other little fishes put their heads out and laughed at Mr. Jeremy Fisher. And while Mr. Jeremy sat disconsolately on the edge of his boat, sucking his sore fingers and peering down into the water, a much worse thing happened. A really frightful thing it would have been if Mr. Jeremy had not been wearing a Macintosh. A great, big, enormous trout came up.
Kerflop! With a splash! and it sees Mr. Jeremy with a snap.
Ow! Ow! Ow!
And then it turned and dived down to the bottom of the pond. But the trout was so displeased with the taste of the Macintosh that in less than half a minute, it spat him out again, and the only thing it swallowed was Mr. Jeremy's galoshes. Mr. Jeremy bounced up to the surface of the water like a cork and the bubbles out of a soda water bottle, and he swam with all his might to the edge of the pond. He scrambled out on the first bank he came to, and he hopped home across the meadow with his Macintosh all in tatters. "What a mercy that was not a pike," said Mr. Jeremy Fisher. "I have lost my rod and basket, but it does not much matter, for I'm sure I should never have dared to go fishing again." He put some sticking plaster on his fingers, and his friends both came to dinner. He could not offer them fish, but he had something else in his larder. Sir Isaac Newton wore his black and gold waistcoat. And Mr. Alderman Ptolemy Tortoise brought a salad with him in a string bag. And instead of a nice dish of minnows, they had a roasted grasshopper with ladybird sauce, which frogs consider a beautiful treat. But I think it must have been quite nasty. Ugh. Now here's the moral of this story that everybody should know. One can still be generous even if things don't go as planned. That was a pretty entertaining story, but let's read some more. There's more of Tristan's Storytime coming right up. Now I'm going to talk about two very important lessons that everyone should learn. Just because a girl's got long hair doesn't mean she can't put it to good use. That was the first one. You want to know what the second one is? Listen to this fairy tale and you'll find out. This one is written by the Grimm brothers, or the Brothers Grimm, and is called Rapunzel. There was once a man and a woman who had long in vain wished for a child. At length, the woman hoped that God was about to grant her desire. These people had a little window in the back of their house from which a splendid garden could be seen, which was full of the most beautiful flowers and herbs. It was, however, surrounded by a high wall, and no one dared to go into it because it belonged to an enchantress who had great power and was dreaded by all the world. One day, the woman was standing by this window and looking down into the garden when she saw a bed which was planted with the most beautiful rampion, which is called Rapunzel, and it looked so fresh and green that she longed for it. She quite pined away and began to look pale and miserable. Then her husband was alarmed and asked, "What ails you, dear wife?"
"Ah," she replied, "if I can't eat some of the rampion which is in the garden behind our house, I shall die."
The man who loved her thought, "Sooner than let your wife die, bring her some of the rampion yourself. Let it cost what it will."
At twilight, he clambered down over the wall into the garden of the enchantress, hastily clutched a handful of rampion, and took it to his wife. She at once made herself a salad of it, and ate it greedily. It tasted so good to her, so very good, that the next day she longed for it three times as much as before. If he was to have any rest, her husband must once more descend into the garden. In the gloom of evening, therefore, he let himself down again. But when he had clambered down the wall, he was terribly afraid, for he saw the enchantress standing before him.
"How can you dare," said she with angry look, "descend into my garden and steal my rampion like a thief? You should suffer for it."
"Ah," answered he, "let mercy take the place of justice. I only made up my mind to do it out of necessity. My wife saw your rampion from the window and felt such a longing for it that she would have died if she had not got some to eat."
Then the enchantress allowed her anger to be softened and said to him,
"If the case be as you say, I will allow you to take away with you as much rampion as you will. Only I make one condition. You must give me the child which your wife will bring into the world. It shall be well treated, and I will care for it like a mother.
The man, in his terror, consented to everything, and when the woman was brought to bed, the enchantress appeared at once, gave the child the name of Rapunzel, and took it away with her. Rapunzel grew into the most beautiful child under the sun. When she was 12 years old, the enchantress shut her into a tower, which lay in a forest, and had neither stairs nor door. But quite at the top was a little window. When the enchantress wanted to go in, she placed herself beneath it and cried,
"Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let down your hair to me."
Rapunzel had magnificent long hair, fine as spun gold. And when she heard the voice of the enchantress, she unfastened her braided tresses, wound them round one of the hooks of the window above, and then the hair fell 20 ells down, and the enchantress climbed up by it. After a year or two, it came to pass that the king's son rode through the forest and passed by the tower. Then he heard a song, which was so charming that he stood still and listened. This was Rapunzel, who in her solitude passed her time in letting her sweet voice respond. The king's son wanted to climb up to her and looked for the door of the tower, but none was to be found. He rode home, but the singing had so deeply touched his heart that every day he went out into the forest and listened to it. Once when he was thus standing behind a tree, he saw that an enchantress came there, and he heard how she cried,
"Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let down your hair to me."
Then Rapunzel let down the braids of her hair, and the enchantress climbed up to her. "If that is the ladder by which one mounts, I too will try my fortune," said he, and the next day, when it began to grow dark, he went to the tower and cried,
"Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let down your hair to me."
Immediately the hair fell down, and the king's son climbed up. At first Rapunzel was terribly frightened when a man, such as her eyes had never yet beheld, came to her. But the king's son began to talk to her quite like a friend, and told her that his heart had been so stirred that it had let him have no rest, and he had been forced to see her. Then Rapunzel lost her fear, and when he asked her if she would take him for her husband, and she saw that he was young and handsome, she thought,
"He will love me more than old Dame Gothel does."
And she said yes, and laid her hand in his. She said,
"I will willingly go away with you, but I do not know how to get down. Bring with you a skein of silk every time that you come, and I will weave a ladder with it, and when that is ready, I will descend, and you will take me on your horse."
They agreed that until that time he should come to her every evening, for the old woman came by day. The enchantress remarked nothing of this until once Rapunzel said to her,
"Tell me, Dame Gothel, how it happens that you are so much heavier for me to draw up than the young king's son. He is with me in a moment."
"Ah, you wicked child," cried the enchantress. "What do I hear you say? I thought I had separated you from all the world, and yet you have deceived me."
In her anger, she clutched Rapunzel's beautiful tresses, wrapped them twice round her left hand, seized a pair of scissors with the right, and snip, snap, they were cut off, and the lovely braids lay on the ground. And she was so pitiless that she took poor Rapunzel into a desert where she had to live in great grief and misery. On the same day that she cast out Rapunzel, however, the enchantress fastened the braids of hair, which she had cut off, to the hook of the window. And when the king's son came and cried,
"Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let down your hair to me,"
she let the hair down. The king's son ascended, but instead of finding his dearest Rapunzel, he found the enchantress, who gazed at him with wicked and venomous looks.
"Aha!"
she cried mockingly.
"You would fetch your dearest, but the beautiful bird sits no longer singing in the nest. The cat has got it, and will scratch out your eyes as well. Rapunzel is lost to you. You will never see her again."
The king's son was beside himself with pain, and in his despair, he leapt down from the tower. He escaped with his life, but the thorns into which he fell pierced his eyes. Then he wandered quite blind about the forest, ate nothing but roots and berries, and did naught but lament and weep over the loss of his dearest wife. Thus he roamed about in misery for some years, and at length came to the desert where Rapunzel, with the twins to which she had given birth, a boy and a girl, lived in wretchedness. He heard a voice, and it seemed so familiar to him that he went towards it. And when he approached, Rapunzel knew him and fell on his neck and wept. Two of her tears wetted his eyes, and they grew clear again, and he could see with them as before. He led her to his kingdom, where he was joyfully received, and they lived for a long time afterwards, happy and contented. And now here's that second lesson of this story, which is actually our moral. You can't keep your children from all the evils of the world. You also can't stop the cycle of life. I hear more stories calling my name. Are they calling for yours? Stick around and you'll find out as Tristan's Storytime continues. I'm going to provide a perfect example as to why tortoises must always stay in their shells. And this fable is called The Tortoise and the Ducks by Aesop. The tortoise, as you know, carries his house on his back. No matter how hard he tries, he cannot leave home. They say that Jupiter punished him so because he was such a lazy stay-at-home that he would not go to Jupiter's wedding, even when especially invited. After many years, Tortoise began to wish he had gone to that wedding. When he saw how gaily the birds flew about and how the hare and the chipmunk and all the other animals ran nimbly by, always eager to see everything there was to be seen, the tortoise felt very sad and discontented. He wanted to see the world too, and there he was with a house on his back and little short legs that could hardly drag him along. One day, he met a pair of ducks and told them all his trouble.
"We can help you see the world," said the ducks. "Take hold of this stick with your teeth, and we will carry you far up into the air where you can see the whole countryside. But keep quiet, or you will be sorry."
The tortoise was very glad indeed. He seized the stick firmly with his teeth. The two ducks took hold of it, one at each end, and away they sailed up towards the clouds. Just then, a crow flew by. He was very much astonished at the strange sight and cried,
"This must surely be King of Tortoises."
"Why, certainly," began the tortoise.
But as he opened his mouth to say those foolish words, he lost his hold on the stick, and down he fell to the ground, where he was dashed to pieces on a rock. That poor, unfortunate tortoise should have learned this lesson. Foolish curiosity and vanity often lead to misfortune. Today's nursery rhyme gives us the pleasure of marveling at the beauty of the night sky. And this one is called Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. Lyrics are by Jane Taylor. This might even help you get ready for bed. So come along, sing along to Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star.
Twinkle, twinkle, little star.
That was beautiful. But now I have to read another story. There's more of Tristan's Storytime coming up. I'm going to tell you a poem where it describes a theme of arrogance and overconfidence. In this poem, finally after other players get on base, the crowd is thrilled to see Casey at the bat, since he has a reputation as an amazing player. Now here's the poem called Casey at the Bat by Ernest Lawrence Thayer, and it's also in rhyme. It looked extremely rocky for the Mudville Nine that day. The score stood 4-6 with just an inning left to play. And so when Cooney died at first, and Barrows did the same, a pallor wreathed the features of the patrons of the game. A straggling few got up to go, leaving there the rest, with that hope that springs eternal within the human breast. For they thought if only Casey could get one whack at that, they'd put up even money with Casey at the bat. But Flynn preceded Casey, and so likewise did Blake. But the former was a pudding, and the latter was a fake. So on that stricken multitude a death-like silence sat, for there seemed but little chance of Casey's getting to the bat. But Flynn let drive a single to the wonderment of all, and the much-despised Blakey tore the cover off the ball. And when the dust had lifted and they saw what had occurred, there was Blakey safe on second and Flynn a hugging third. Then from the gladdened multitude went up a joyous yell. It bounded from the mountaintop and rattled in the dell. It struck upon the hillside and rebounded on the flat, for Casey, mighty Casey, was advancing to the bat. There was ease in Casey's manner as he stepped into his place. There was pride in Casey's bearing and a smile on Casey's face. And when responding to the cheers, he lightly doffed his hat. No stranger in the crowd could doubt 'twas Casey at the bat. 10,000 eyes were on him as he rubbed his hands with dirt. 5,000 tongues applauded when he wiped them on his shirt. Then while the writhing pitcher ground the ball into his hip, defiance glanced in Casey's eye, a sneer curled Casey's lip. And now the leather-covered sphere came hurtling through the air, and Casey stood a-watching in haughty grandeur there. Close by the sturdy batsman, the ball unheeded sped. "That ain't my style," said Casey. "Strike one," the umpire said. From the benches, black with people, there went up a muffled roar, like the beating of the storm waves on a stern and distant shore. "Kill him! Kill the umpire!" shouted someone in the stand, and it's likely they'd have killed him had not Casey raised his hand. With a smile of Christian charity, great Casey's visage shone. He stilled the rising tumult. He bade the game go on. He signaled to the pitcher, and once more the spheroid flew. But Casey still ignored it, and the umpire said, "Strike two!" "Fraud!" cried the maddened thousands, and the echo answered, "Fraud!" But the scornful look from Casey and the audience was awed. They saw his face grow stern and cold. They saw his muscles strain. And they knew that Casey wouldn't let that ball go by again. The sneer is gone from Casey's lip. His teeth are clenched with hate. He pounds with cruel violence his bat upon the plate.
And now the pitcher holds the ball. And now he lets it go. And now the air is shattered by the force of Casey's blow. Oh, somewhere in this favored land, the sun is shining bright. The band is playing somewhere, and somewhere hearts are light. And somewhere men are laughing, and somewhere children shout. But there is no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck out. Well, I'm sure we all have team heroes that are larger than life. When these great ones step up to the plate, we expect more of them than others. When they show their human side, a lot of us are stung. Well, that's our show. Thanks for listening. But before I go, I must ask you, did you enjoy the show? I certainly felt energized by it. As always, feel free to comment on the Tristan Storytime Facebook page. And don't forget to give it a like. And you want to know where you can find other episodes of Tristan Storytime? You can find them on podbean.com. Just look for Tristan Storytime. And if you want to listen to it on your mobile device, download the Podbean app, which is available in the App Store or the Google Play Store. It's free for any mobile device. Ah, so many stories, so little time. Which I, unfortunately, am out of. But fear not, I'll be back next time. Until then, I'm Tristan Gardner. Thank you for listening, and God bless, my friends. And remember, keep using your imaginations. Today's stories and nursery rhymes are The Tale of Mr. Jeremy Fisher, written and illustrated by Beatrix Potter, published in 1906 by Frederick Warren and Company. Rapunzel, taken from Grimm's Fairy Tales by the Brothers Grimm, originally published in 1812. The Tortoise and the Ducks, taken from the Aesop for Children by Aesop, pictures by Myla Winter, published in 1919 by Rand McNally and Company. Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, written by Jane Taylor. Originally published in 1806. Music arrangement by the Green Orbs. Casey at the Bat, poem originally written in 1888 by Ernest Lawrence Thayer. Taken from The Wit and Humor of America, Volume 6. Edited by Marshall P. Wilder. Published in 1907 by Funk and Wagnalls Company.